You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program. This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment.
This woman is from South Africa. She worked for Reuters over in South Africa, and then CBS News, and then ABC and NBC and CNN. She was, in 2002, she was on the battlefields all around the world as we were engaging in war. She was part of Face the Nation and the CBS Morning News. And then in 2006, she became the chief foreign correspondent for CBS News. And she held that job up until recently. But something has changed in her. And maybe it's just her freedom. She is able to say the things that nobody seems to be saying anywhere. Her name is Lara Logan. And she joins us in 1 minute.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Journalist and a profile in Courage, Lara Logan, joins us now. Lara, nice to meet you and nice to have you on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's get right into what you're doing recently, and then I'd like to kind of open it up to more broad on the media and what to expect and what we can do to change things. But you've been down on our border. And strangely, you have a different report than what the mainstream media is giving everyone.
Well, you know, to be honest, I don't watch what the mainstream media is giving everybody, especially when I'm working, right? Because my job is, I'm focused on doing my job.
Yeah.
I'm not too worried about what other people are doing. And a wise old correspondent told me many years ago that he, you know, every day he goes out and he does his best. And he doesn't worry about his competition. And some days he's the best and some days he's not. So, but it's not surprising to me that it's different because I know where I go, people all the time along the border in all different capacities keep saying, nobody is telling our story. Mm-hmm. Nobody is talking about this. Nobody's telling the truth. You know, it's not that people are lying about the border. It's not that there's, it's just that there's more than one story. The only story is not simply a story of, you know, of poor people who want to move mm-hmm. to the United States to improve their lives. That is one part of the story, and it's a very important part of the story. And I can honestly tell you, I've had moments where, you know, I've been climbing into my, my pretty crappy bed in my pretty crappy hotel at night. And I've just about wanted to cry thinking about the people who don't even know, you know, the people I've seen with their children and all the rest of it. I mean, I've got a big heart and that breaks my heart, mm-hmm. but it's only one part of the story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my job as a reporter has always been to understand the full context and cover as much of the story as I can. And that's all I'm trying to do.
So there are the sins of omission, and I think that's what people are committing by saying that this is the only part of the story. And you're right. I've been down at the border myself, and you know we raised money to bring food and comfort down to some of the children that were there during the Obama administration. I tried to get the media to pay attention to the cages.
Oh, you're not allowed to talk about that, Ken.
I know. But it doesn't happen, and it shows this real bias. And I don't want to dwell on this.
I've got one worse for you. Yeah. I've got one worse for you. I have actually spoken to people down there, right across law enforcement and Border Patrol, who actually talk about when in a certain point in the Obama administration, when they no longer wanted to deal with the deporter-in-chief title and the problem of all the children that they had in detention, basically in prison, some people like to so-called that cages. What did they do? Actually, Border Patrol agents then had orders where they would have to intercept people who they found coming over the border in certain parts, and they would have to escort them back down to the border and send them back. Don't apprehend them. Don't create a statistic. Don't create a problem for us. Let's just push you over the border then and pretend that this is not happening. That was, I can't say how widespread that was. I can't say that it was everywhere, but I can tell you that it did happen, and more than once.
So what is it that people are saying, nobody's telling this story? What are the important stories that we're not hearing?
Well, first and foremost, what people just leave out of the narrative is that this is almost like a theater. It's a performance, not for the people who are living it, because they are like their pawns. It's a theater for the cartels. Yes, they make an enormous amount of money out of all the people that cross because they take most of the smuggling fees. They don't run the smuggling operations. They're way too smart for that. They have professional human smuggling operations, human trafficking organizations that are global who do the smuggling for them. But they pay most, an enormous amount of what they earn, they pay that to the cartels. The Mexican cartels decide who crosses, where they cross, when they cross. And so if you imagine you're a pilot and you can see the whole border from the air, that's really how the cartels operate. You know, it's divided up into the three main cartels now, the Sinaloa cartel, the Gulf cartel, and what used to be called the Zetas. That's now Cartel del Nostre. But those are the three main cartels that control the traffic. And the reason you have people coming in all these difficult places, one of the reasons, a big reason, is that the cartels know if they split the resources of Border Patrol, if you've got a group of 5 people or a group of 10 people and they all run in different directions, how many agents does it now take to stop them? You know, so that's exactly what they're doing. They're splitting the resources. Pilots have described to me, for example, in parts of the border, seeing groups of anywhere between 50 and 200 crossing at exactly the state at the same time at the crossing points, sort of, you know, 100 yards from each other, right? So imagine in 5 different places separated by 100 yards, and you have hundreds of people. So what does that do? In one tiny little town on the border in Texas, on the Rio Grande Valley, they have Border Patrol facilities that are built to house a maximum of 116 people. Last weekend, they had over 1,100. Over 1,100 in one weekend, and they have people every single day. And that's just one weekend. This has been going on for months and months and months. So in these places where people get, people get told all the time, Texans, for example, Texans are a bunch of racist rednecks, right? And Texans don't care about people. Look, they don't recognize the children of illegal immigrants born in this country. Look at all the evil things people in Texas do. They put illegal immigrants under bridges in terrible weather to suffer. Well, literally, you've got Border Patrol agents looking at me with desperation saying, we don't know where else to put people. You've got churches in El Paso who the NGOs have run out of capacity, right? The NGOs that come from New York and other parts of the country that like to do interviews in the paper sometimes about everything they're doing down on the border, except they've run out of capacity. And it's the local people in many of these places who are trying to bear, you know, to help in some ways. And the other, you know, there's another really important thing that gets left out of the narrative, which is that the large majority of Border Patrol agents are Hispanic Americans or Mexican Americans or whatever you want to call them. They're not, you know, it's not just these evil white men who are trying to stop people coming into this country. It's not that at all. In fact, it's much more complex. And in some of these towns, the vast majority of the people who live there are Hispanic American. And you know, Texas itself has a history that's very much wrapped up in Mexico. And the first president of Texas was Mexican. And when you look at the history here, these two people, I'm not painting a picture of nirvana. There's always issues between people, but it's very different to what people say it is from a distance. The reality is not much like that at all. And I have I have yet to meet anyone who wants these people to suffer or who is deliberately cruel to people. And, you know, my experience is limited to my experience, you know.
But I will tell you this. When you say these people are pawns, they are. They're being, I feel horrible for them. Because if in some cases, not all cases, but in many cases, I think if I were on the other side of the border and I saw that America really didn't care about its borders and they were going to give away free citizenship and I could get my family there, and my family doesn't, we're living in a town that maybe has violence but doesn't have any real chance for my kids, you're damn right I'd be over here. I would absolutely do it because I would think that America didn't really care and they were offering citizenship. So take that chance for my children to be able to have a better life. Those people are being preyed on by all these different groups that have all different agendas, including the drug cartels that are holding back some family members and saying, look, we're going to sell you this and we'll bring them over. You do us a favor, we'll do you a favor, and then we'll send your relative over. And I mean, we're importing people and enslaving people to some of these drug cartels.
Oh, no, we're doing the bidding of the drug cartels. Yes, whether wittingly or unwittingly, that's happening. And I can tell you, I can add to what you're saying, Glenn. How about if you were watching or listening to commercials on the radio, which tell you, go to America, you're going to get a house, you're going to get land, you're going to get a job, you're going to get this or that. And then add to that the fact that, you know, I mean, one of my most trusted, the person that I respect most in the world, my producer, Max McClellan, he went and did a story in a series of reports in Honduras. He was actually with a family when they said goodbye to their 15-year-old daughter and sent her to a better life in America. And you can imagine, right? I mean, he's a dad. He's got a daughter. I have two daughters and a son. I mean, what could be more heartbreaking than that? I mean, it's really painful for me to even imagine being in that situation. But they don't even know if their daughter is actually going to a real job in America.
There's so much sex trafficking. And you imagine sending your 15-year-old daughter into...
Nobody does that unless they are absolutely desperate or they have no other options, right? Nobody, I mean, the family, the mother was sobbing, the father was crying, the daughter was crying. You can imagine. That's a very painful thing. So, but her chance, she has a significant chance of being raped along the way.
Oh, yeah.
When people come from Latin America, they get to the first stash house inside of Mexico. People get raped at the stash houses. And then there's another stash house. You know, there's other stash houses all along the way, but right on the Mexican side, close to the border. And then more stash houses when you cross the border. And I've been looking at doing stories on this. We have reports of different people who get raped at every one of those locations along the way. And then, you know, but we're still trying to find someone who has been through that to talk about it, because these things are very difficult to cover.
Yes.
And also because, you know, it's very easy to tear these stories apart. This is, here, I have one for you. This is the only time in my career as a journalist, a professional, where I have looked at the statistics of rape and sexual abuse, right? Trying to figure out, okay, how prevalent is this? What exactly are the facts? What is the chance when you get on that journey that this is going to happen to you? How bad is it, truly, right? And in this case, this is one case where the media, by and large, says, oh, you can't prove that this is happening. Oh, you know, yes, there was this MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, the NGO, they did a big study on it, and they found that, you know, at least 30% of the women making this journey get raped or sexually assaulted. But what do you have many journalists turning around and saying then? Well, they took a sample of people on their way to the U.S. in Mexico. They didn't, you know, take everybody, and they didn't take everybody from every different country. And so you get 15 reasons why the MSF statistic is not representative. Well, you know, isn't the standard, the way we normally in the media treat rape and sexual assault figures, is we always say it's the most underreported crime, don't we? Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yep.
And it's just a small irony that I that I noticed when I was researching this story. I thought, wow, all my professional life, you know, wherever I've been, people have said that there's, you know, if that's the official figure, you can bet it's going to be much more than that.
Yes.
Now here you have people actually defending human traffickers, defending cartels, defending coyotes who rape people, and saying, well, you know, it's, we can't trust that figure because it's not fully representative.
So, Laura, I want to break for a minute, literally 1 minute, and then I want to come back and I want to ask you why? How is that happening, that intelligent people are taking sides of monsters and they don't see it that way? Back in 1 minute with Laura Logan. You can follow her at lauralogan.com, lauralogan.com.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
John Douglas, the original Mind Hunter, is on with us now. Hello, John. How are you, sir?
Very well, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to talk to you. I remember what you went through when you first started talking to people, because I remember my grandfather saying, these guys are just talking to them. They're going to make excuses. I don't care what happened to them in their life. They did the crime. And that was the prevalent theory when you started interviewing these mass murderers.
Correct. At the FBI, very, very much what's happening on the series, the Mindhunter series on Netflix, the question was, why am I doing this? What are you doing? You shouldn't be going into the prisons doing these interviews. Well, at the time I was 32 years old, I came back to Quantico after working 7 years in the field. I was a very young agent when I was recruited. I just got out of the military, had 4 years of military, a couple advanced degrees, and came back. And with sitting back in the classroom now, I had to audit the senior instructors, and these senior instructors just didn't have their facts right. And how do I know that? Because there were police officers in the classroom that were challenging the instructors, and they say, hey, look, you know, I worked the Manson case. You got your facts all screwed up. So here I am now, 32 years old, and I got to get up in front of these senior investigators from throughout the world and FBI agents, you know, at some point. And what can I do to accelerate my learning? So in the old days, we had what we call road schools. You go out and maybe teaching in San Diego, then later on Boise, Idaho. And, you know, let's go into these prisons. I asked my partner. I said, let's go. Let's see if Manson will talk to us. Let's see if David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, or Sirhan, and thought it was a crazy idea, but went into the prisons just unannounced, which was kind of good. When you're an agent, you just show your creds, you can go in, and you don't have to tell anybody why you want to speak to these people. And to our surprise, they were very, 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 very forthcoming, very, very interested in speaking with me. But we made mistakes early on in the when we first started doing the interviews. Would go in there with notes, go in there with a tape recorder, and that was a turnoff for them. Why? Because they're paranoid individuals, and they should be paranoid. They're incarcerated with a lot of other violent offenders. They don't trust corrections. They're certainly not going to trust the FBI. So what I began to do as we went along, and we teamed up with Dr. Ann Burgess, Boston College, and we developed a computerized instrument for interviews, which I would never fill out during the interview process. It would be before and after the interview. And then started to document this material and began to get some really fantastic information from them regarding victim selection, pre-offense behavior, post-offense behavior. Then I started thinking, what can I do creatively to create a situation where I may cause David Berkowitz, for example, to go to the gravesite of his victims or to inject himself into the police investigation. Well, the Bureau stood afar. They were really against this. You know, what the hell are you doing? You know, this kind of work. And they were really the last ones to embrace my own agency. They were waiting for me, I think, to screw up, and then they'd send me to Butte, Montana, to work cattle rustling, you know, cases or
right.
something like that. So you know, they were the last ones, you know, to embrace it. And then when I got really some international publicity, and I was doing so many cases, but then when I hit the Atlanta child killings was very controversial. I was censured by the Bureau when I publicly said the killer would be a black offender, would not be white in that particular case. And historically, we had a lot of white serial killers leading up to that time. And when they finally arrested Wayne B. Williams in the case, then I got involved in cross-examination strategies, coaching the prosecutor on how to go after him on the stand. And again, I was very, 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 very young. But now, as this young agent, and when I would now get in front of a group, senior agents, you know, you're like the old show E.F. Hutton. When E.F. Hutton speaks, everyone listens.
Yeah.
So they started, you know, listening. But along the way, it's stressful, man. It's stressful.
John, let me ask you this on the stress part of it. First of all, I don't want to give any spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen the series on Netflix. But is that last episode, did that at all anything like that? Did you go through that?
Well, it's worse than the episode.
Oh my gosh.
Because that particular way that didn't happen like that, but I was training in New York City in 1983, and it was around October, November. And while on stage training several hundred police from Nassau County, Suffolk, all around Manhattan, I just came back on the Yorkshire Ripper case. I have to go up to Alaska where a guy is hunting down women. He's abducting women, stripping them down naked as he takes them to his airplane, flies them up into the wilderness and hunts them down.
Oh,
and then there's the Green River Killer in Seattle, Washington. So I had this anxiety attack while on stage, and I know my material so well that my mouth is talking, but my brain is elsewhere. And I feel like I'm having a heart attack. I'm perspiring. I'm saying to myself, I'm saying, Douglas, man, you got to regroup. You got to come out of this. Refocus. And so I got through it. I don't think no one ever said anything. No one ever detected it. But by the time I got back to Quantico, I felt at 38 years of age, I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm going to have cancer. Something's going to happen to me. So I took out all this income protection insurance. And then it's now time to go out on the Green River murder case in Seattle, Washington. I have tremendous headaches. I have to train two younger agents now assigned to my program. And the long and short out there, what happened was, is before I went to before the task force, come back to my hotel room, tell the agents I feel like I'm getting a flu. And that night I collapsed in my hotel room floor. They kicked down the door 3 days later because I have a do not disturb sign on the door. And they find me in a frog-like position. My brain had split in the right temporal lobe from 107-degree body temperature. My heartbeat's 220, and I'm in a coma. And I'll remain in a coma for a week and come out of the coma paralyzed all along the left side, can't speak. Before I came out of the coma, they were planning, I'm a veteran, they were planning to bury me at the veteran cemetery. And the doctors later on, when I came back, they flew me back after a month in the hospital back to where I live in Virginia, went to various doctors, went to psychologists, and the psychologist tested me, and they said, John, I said, man, well, first you have viral encephalitis brought on, your immune system is so low, you came very close to dying, plus you had complications of blood clots that nearly killed you, and he says, but you were really suffering this post-traumatic stress disorder and some of the things we see and our veterans coming back, but you're experiencing the same kind of thing here, dealing with death and violence and dealing with the victims of these violent crimes that break your heart, when you have to deal with them, or when a victim mother tells you, John, you have to tell me how my daughter was killed.
Oh my gosh.
Did my daughter fight? And, you know, on and on. And it really is it was emotionally exhausting.
So, John, did you because in watching you and in reading these books that you've written, you, at least I am, I think the toll on you on sitting, you know, and intentionally making them feel superior to you by adjusting the chair so they're higher than you are and doing all these things, yeah, and befriending them, it just seems like there is a, you're paying a price in your soul to be able to get this information.
Well, yeah, I give you an example. I interviewed Richard Speck, who killed 7 nurses in the Chicago area, and he was extremely violent. They were holding him in a cage, and they wanted me to show me his cell first and his pornography in his cell. But meanwhile, he's screaming and yelling like crazy. And when I finally got back in his cage with him, I was with his counselor. I decided to totally ignore him and turn my back to him. And I had a conversation with his counselor. And I used street language in talking to his counselor about the crimes that he committed, you know, kind of filthy kind of language, but the kind of language that, you know, Richard Speck can identify with. And I said something to the effect that, you know, to his counselor, I said, I don't know what this guy eats for breakfast, but man, I said, he raped these 7, seven women. I just don't understand it. I knew he didn't do that. So he chimes in behind me, and he's sitting up on top of Cardenza. I'm 6'2", and he's 6'2" as well, but he still wants to dominate, you know, over me, and you let him do it. And he says, I didn't, and using street terms, what he did to those girls. And I said, I know. I said, it was just the one on the couch. And he says, you're crazy, man. You ought to be in here, you know, with us. I mean, you're just like us. And I'm really not just like him, but I have to show this false sense of empathy. And I'd be lying to you, Glenn, if I tell you at the end of the day, when I have to come back to my own family and at the time, and then the young children, that have and that you may have flashbacks, you may even be in bed with your wife one night, and you're thinking that some amorous type of thing you may want to be doing, but now you're thinking about some horrific case
that you're
working on, and it's really it's dangerous to your health.
All right, I want to take a.
I assume you don't tell her that on date night.
Yeah,
you know, like, oh, honey, yeah, you know what I'm thinking about right now.
Gosh. John, I'm going to take a quick break for about a minute, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation. But I just have to thank you for what you've endured as a human being, for all of our sakes. You put up with both sides, the law and the devil, and took a lot of grief, and thank you for standing and doing that.
Well, thank you.
Back in just one more minute.
Fascinating. Wow.
John Douglas, the killer across the table. He is the original Mindhunter. That if you've seen the Netflix show, this is the guy.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Dave Rubin, how are you, sir?
Glenn, it's good to be with you.
Where are you? Like the North Pole? This is the worst phone connection I've heard since my grandmother.
Are we on a bad connection here? I'm in my backyard at the moment because LA AT&T service is hit or miss.
Yeah, well, wow, it's bad.
Let me see if I can shift into.
No, it's fine. It just sounds like you're using an old timey phone and a lot of hiss. It's like, I've got a person to person, coast to coast call for you, Mr. Beck.
Well, Glenn, I have to go on the assumption that, you know, I've been dealing with these problems with YouTube, that it must be the phone company coming after me, too.
That's right. Congratulations on 1 million subscribers on YouTube. And I know you have taken some pretty big risks recently to stand up for your principles, and putting your eggs in the YouTube basket is really kind of a frightening thing. And it is paying off for you in some regard. I know that they demonetize you. If you have anybody that is slightly to the right of Bernie Sanders, I know they flag you immediately.
Well, it's pretty crazy what they're doing. And, you know, this is a really, really interesting debate that we've discussed a little bit before, where it's starting to push my libertarian side, which is the core of what I am. It's pushing my libertarian side to its limits because, look, these are private companies, and in my estimation, they can do what they want to do. Nobody's forcing me to be on YouTube. I'm voluntarily using their service. They provide when they're doing it right, and people are getting your videos and they're staying subscribed and all those things. They're providing an incredible service and all of those things. So I say that primarily, but the next part is, have these tech companies become so awesomely powerful that we actually can't even grapple with how much information they control, how much power they have, the amount of connections that they have with the government at this point. These are all things that we have to think about. And, you know, there is a seemingly really big push I'm seeing on the right now from conservatives to ask for government intervention.
Don't.
The big tech.
Bad idea.
Yeah.
Bad idea.
Well, so look, I get why in the short term people think this will be good, because it does seem that conservatives are getting banned more. But you have to always take, you know, a couple steps down the road with these things. And the point is, well, if you hand over the power to the government, I mean, first off, the idea that the government could run tech companies or regulate tech companies. I mean, when was the last time you were on a government website? It looks like AOL in 1994. So that's just like the easy version of it. But the real issue, of course, is that, so let's say you hand over the power to the government to regulate or to be in charge of these tech companies or break them up or whatever it is. Well, the government now, a Trump, you know, conservative presidency might be friendly to conservatives right now. But what happens if the democratic socialists get in power and now they've got the tech companies? We know they have the tech companies, and now they've got the government, too. I mean, how quickly do you think they'll be banning all of the people that they deem to be, you know, Nazis and white supremacists and the rest of it? So that's where, you know, I know you know this, but that, of course, is where you really have to be leery of using power until the absolute last second.
First of all, you know, regulation, you know, when Mark Zuckerberg comes out and is begging for regulation, you know, it's in his best interest at Facebook to have regulation. And the reason why is because they will come to those people and those companies and say, how do we regulate? And they will write the laws which will take all competition and crush any possible contender to their throne. On top of that, if we get them and we go to them and say, how do we regulate you? And they get their regulation, it will not only crush all competition, but on top of it, it will then make the Bill of Rights absolutely worthless, because these are companies that are private, and so they do have a right. But if they're the backbone, and because of regulation, that's really all our choice, they can ban any voice and you have nowhere to go, because the Bill of Rights does not apply to them. It will apply to the government.
So this is the catch-22. And I think for people like us that put liberty before everything else, I think this is the tricky spot that we're in. Because, look, but, you know, Glenn, you've built an incredible company using digital properties, right? Like, I'm on YouTube. We do podcasts and all sorts of things. Now, the simple truth is, you probably have some extra protections because of the way I think you have a technology arm of the Blaze. So some of your stuff is proprietary. But which is actually probably the way all creators should be going ultimately, and I've been researching a little bit into that. But the point is that right this moment, as we're talking, technically, there's nothing that I can do to stop YouTube from just shutting me off and iTunes kicking me out and the rest of it.
Correct.
And it's like that is a truly, truly awesome power that they have, especially as we know that all of this seems to be getting ramped up to 2020. So it's putting all of us, especially the liberty-minded folks, in a really weird position. And what I'm afraid of is I'm seeing too many conservatives, you know, chomp at the bit here and say, you know, regulate.
It's the wrong way
and
to go.
It will just be used together. Now, that being said, you know, creating the competition. So for people like us that believe in competition, right, we believe in human ingenuity. We believe we can solve problems. And I would always rather the free market solve things. I mean, there's still a major issue here, which is that the amount of money and resources to solve these problems is so massive. And, you know, there's blockchain technologies and all sorts of interesting things that are still sort of years away from being mass adopted. So we're just at a unique point. And, you know, hopefully those of us that are doing good work and trying to get some truth out there, you know, hopefully it's not being turned against us just yet. But you just don't know. You really don't.
Dave, I want to make a pitch for somebody. There is a guy who wrote the book, The History of the Future. His name is Blake Harris. Do you know who he is?
Mm-hmm. You know, his name has come across every now and again. I get messages suddenly, and a few people have messaged me about him.
You need to have him on. I've had him on several times, and the story that he tells, he's just like you. I mean, he was a liberal, and now he's kind of like, wait a minute. That's not what I bought into. I'm on the wrong side. And he's much more of a classic liberal, very, very freedom minded, but he has the inside scoop of what's happening with Zuckerberg and Facebook. He has evidence of laws being broken by Mark Zuckerberg himself. It's incredible, and no one in the media is giving him any attention. And you know, his books, you know, one of his first book is being made into was made into a movie and now a TV show. And
Seth Rogen is in it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
interesting. You know, yeah, I do know who he is. He's the guy that wrote the book about Oculus and some of the internal documents that were going around.
Yes.
Yeah. I will talk to him for sure. And it's super interesting. And, you know, that actually brings up a good point. Something that I was sort of tweeting about this morning is that the other thing that we're seeing right now, you know, in an age of fake news, it's not just sort of the nonsense that the media puts out that's fake news and the manipulation and, you know, quotes where they literally take out the word not at the beginning of the sentence or any other stuff. It's also what they refuse to report on. So, for example, you know, I'm sure you talked about it on your show, but Brian Sims, the state rep in Pennsylvania, who was harassing those little girls outside of the abortion clinic. It's like CNN did not even touch that story. And that is a type of fake news that we need to be aware of. You know, that the Muslim school in Philadelphia where they were literally training jihadists.
Yes.
There's jihadists.
Yes.
Also in Philadelphia. It's like that wasn't touched. And it's like if you took the reverse of any of these where this was a Christian school or it was a Christian man harassing somebody else or a Republican or a conservative doing any of these things, if you flip the immutable characteristics on these things, the media would be in an outrage. So we need to really recalibrate how we're looking at media as a whole.
It's why
and that's, of course, directly related to all of the stuff we're talking about with the tech companies.
It's honestly why we have to talk to one another, because we just assume that the Democrats that we might know, and I'm not talking about the activists, I'm talking about just the average Democrat that we know. We think that they know these stories. And I did this with Riaz Patel, who is a guy who is very liberal. And after the election, I brought him in and I said, let me show you these stories. I just picked like 10 or 15 stories. This is why we were so upset at Barack Obama. And I gave him the stories. And I think about 8 out of those 10 stories, and he's a well-informed guy, he had never heard of. He was like, what is that? I don't even know what that is. And it was because of the editing of the truth.
Yeah, and this is the huge problem with, you know, look, we're all walking around with iPhones. We have access to information in an absolutely unprecedented way, a way that I think 20 years from now, there will be many, many studies written on how this changed human mind and human communication and all of these things. But, you know, there is a risk here in that, you know, 20 years ago when we had ABC, you know, CBS, NBC, you basically got the same stories out of the three networks. Cable news then erupted and you got a little bit of a widening of that. And now we live in a time where there's basically no safeguards whatsoever. Now, I generally think that's a good thing. But the problem is that we're all catering it to ourselves. And then, yes, the good, because I believe, and I know you do too, there are still good liberals out there. But they are having the wool pulled over their eyes and they don't hear these stories. And then, you know, then they see us, you know, sort of ranting and raving about things and they go, you know, they're just nuts. You know, they're aiming the wrong way. And it's like, this is why what I've always said is if the media would just do a decent job, mm-hmm. they don't have to do a great job. They don't even have to do a good job. Truly, I mean this. If they would just be doing a decent job so that I could wake up every morning and look at Twitter and not realize that CNN either misquoted several people or, you know, absolutely ignored a story or whatever it is. If they would just not do that, then the bunch of us that are on the outside of this, that are doing this in a YouTube space or in a podcast space, we wouldn't have as much ammo. And I would actually prefer that. I would find something else to do with my life. I wouldn't mind moving to a farm one day, you know?
Yeah, me too. Me too. Dave, congratulations. Thank you so much. We'll talk again. God bless.
Thank you, my friend. I'll see you soon.
You bet. Dave Rubin from The Rubin Report. By the way, support your hosts, your favorite voices on YouTube. And what you need to do is, like, if you support us, go to my Glenn Beck page and go to the Blaze page, subscribe, and then rate and review. Those two things help, those three things help the other people discover it. People like you, it will help in the algorithm as much as those algorithms would ever help us. Those things have to be done. So you subscribe, and then you rate and you review. And that is what helps spread the word. Do that with Dave Rubin. You can find him YouTube, Dave Rubin, Rubin Report, Glenn Beck, and also The Blaze. Check it out and rate, review, and subscribe.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
You know, it's really there was an article in The Atlantic recently charting the percentage of Americans who dislike political correctness. You know what the poll found? Most Americans can't stand political correctness. Overwhelmingly, most Americans cannot stand it, except one group: progressive activists. Progressive activists, the only ones that strongly back political correctness, and only 30% see it as a problem.
That's amazing. I mean, how is it ruling our society then?
I know.
We all get on. It's not just progressive activists on Twitter trying to get everybody fired.
Here's how it is. The study found that progressive activists, despite their obsession with socialism, their hatred of the patriarchy, and disdain for the rich white men, are overwhelmingly rich, white, and overeducated men. Compared to the rest of the nationally representative polling sample, progressive activists are much more likely to be rich, highly educated, and white. They are nearly twice as likely as the average to make more than $100,000 a year. They are three times as likely to have a postgraduate degree. And while 12% of the overall sample in the study is African American, only 3% of progressive activists are African American. Now, where's the diversity there? The reason why Twitter has so much power and such a left bias is because journalists have become masterful at using it as a feedback loop. Journalists use it as a source, a representation of public opinion, and Twitter users, who are overwhelmingly and disproportionately progressive activists, can enjoy a sense of power that they've clearly only dreamt of. So it becomes this feedback loop. That's why what Dave Rubin is doing, that's why what The Blaze is doing, that's why, you know, Ben Shapiro and what he's doing, and Steven Crowder and all of us, it's why this is so important, because Twitter is not real life. It's not even representative of the actual population.
Yeah, what is it, 4% of all people on Twitter are responsible for 80% of the tweets? Something like that. Maybe it might even be 2%. Was it 2%? I can't remember. It was 2 or 4% responsible for 80% of the tweets. And remember, that is not that many people are on, even on Twitter. I mean, it rules the newscasts because it's easy for journalists. It's a lazy mm-hmm. journalism tool. How do I get mm-hmm. a quote about this story? I used to have to call. I used to have to, you know, get in touch with somebody. I used to have to make, you know, walk up to someone with a microphone. Now it's go to Twitter. What do they tweet about it? Okay, there it is. Pop it in the story. So journalists love it. It makes their lives a lot easier. But, I mean, it's a very small percentage of people who are even on Twitter, let alone following it closely.
And that's what media is reflecting. Mm. This is a parabolic dish. It's not a straight mirror. It's a distortion of reality. It's a funhouse mirror, because that is not reflective of the American people.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.